Heavenly Father, thank you for allowing us to come together. We pray that as we look at 1 Samuel, may we continue to see how rich your word is, especially to learn from the lives of those who have gone before us and to see that there really are so many ways in which we can definitely relate and especially learn from even the mistakes and sometimes the very, very poor decisions that people made. Ones that we are so capable of doing as well. But we also see how faithful you are, how you always give hope, how you have your redemptive plan continually in motion, and to know that because of that, we can look to you and to see that you will provide a way through every difficult decision, every challenge, every trial, every temptation. Pray that we could really learn tonight together. In Jesus' name, amen. All right. You know, when we go through the historical portions of the Bible, how many of you like history? Okay, a few of you. Okay. And the rest of you, you know, how many of you slept through history? So you don't remember anything from history? And so that's kind of unfortunate because I mean, obviously, sometimes it's hard to relate to certain things. Like, I remember studying African history at UCLA. I took an African history class, and I was like, okay, I don't understand how it's relevant to anything. You know, I have no context, actually no interest, so it's kind of hard. I remember studying Korean history on my own. I was very interested in learning, you know, so what's being Korean all about, you know, going back to like the Three Kingdoms, you know, period, and, you know, how they were all kind of fighting against each other at different times. And I guess, you know, Koreans have been fighting ever since the beginning. And, you know, then they all kind of came together under one and then, you know, kind of flipped over different dynasties until the last one, you know, then the Japanese, you know, kind of took over, and then World War II, and then communist era, you know, country split in two. So there's a lot of interesting things that if you were to take the time to look back, you'll understand that there's a reason why certain things have come about. You know, there's a reason why for some people there's tremendous pride in their kind of heritage. For others, there's tremendous shame in their heritage. But either way, it goes back to looking towards one's kind of whole history. Now, we look at the nation of Israel's history, and for us, we might even say, well, how is that relevant to me? Because no one here is Jewish, right? Or I don't know, maybe you might have some Jewish blood in you somewhere down the line, you don't know. But it's not your primary point of identification. So we might say, well, everything about Israel is kind of not relevant. But when you look at the New Testament, we see very clearly that there was a reason why the Old Testament was written, especially in the context of ministry to Gentiles. And so the Gentiles were told to learn from what happened to Israel. So we are included in that Gentile sort of population where we could also look at the history of Israel. And one of the things that really makes the Bible actually very trustworthy is that it doesn't kind of gloss over the ugly stuff. In fact, you see some very, very straightforward kind of representation of the sinfulness of people. You know, and that's not something that you're likely to do, especially if you want to kind of prop up your heritage, right? You're only going to hear the positive things from most people because, you know, it's kind of biased. You don't want people to know all the shameful things. In fact, yesterday, I was at Olivia's school. They had a poem party, and so we were there to hear the kids present poems, and so it was kind of funny. But then when we were talking afterwards, some parents, and one guy just randomly said, oh, I was doing this genealogy sort of kind of project, and I was looking into my family's history, and I found out some weird things about my family, you know, that my grandfather, the person that he thought was his sister was actually his mother. So, Okay, that's weird. I'm not sure how that works, but you know, just kind of like, ooh, you know, that sort of changes everything. Like, you know, like if you thought someone was somebody, or you know, for me, I have a lot of relatives, and you know, some are okay, and some are not so okay. So you know, when you find out about people's family histories too, that's another weird thing. Like when you get married, you kind of marry into like a mess, like that you didn't anticipate, right? Like all the baggage that comes. I mean, you're not marrying the whole family, of course, but you still have to deal with whatever it comes. And then sometimes you're like, ooh, you know. And sometimes there's like these stereotypes. Like I've heard this. It's something like Chinese women are warned to not marry Korean men. Yeah, I've heard that.
Yeah.
But why? Is it because every Korean man is like sketchy? I mean, how does that work? You know? And unfortunately, there's always some example that someone's going to pull, right? Go, see, do you want to end up like this? And you're like, oh, no, I don't. Well, the thing is, if everyone's honest, everyone's got some sketchy history. And it's because we're all sinners, and you just can't avoid it. There is no one who's perfect. You know, there is no one who is good. They're out there. Handouts. So, when we read through biblical history, we get the same sort of very real kind of depiction of people's lives. In the book of 1 Samuel, there's three people that we're going to look at. Samuel, and Saul, and David. And in each of their stories, you're going to find out that they're flawed people, that they're not perfect. I mean, some do better in their walks with God than others, but what we see are some things that seem very unfortunate. And on one hand, that should kind of give you some hope, because all these saints, like even David's called a man after God's own heart. I mean, he actually does some pretty bad things. And from some things which he never fully recovers, because the consequences of his actions are so far-reaching. Yet God still affirms him. Okay, you're going to see a very tragic story in the story of Saul. Right? Someone who was given tremendous opportunity and he squandered it. But why? Like, why did he? Especially when it was handed to him. Samuel, you know, he's the last of the judges. He's the one that ushers in the transition to the time of the kings. And he follows kind of like a very sad situation in Eli, you know, who has not done a good job raising his sons. His sons are making a mockery of the priesthood. And we're going to see just, if you remember when we're going through the story of Judges, how it was sort of descending into just craziness. Right? Moral chaos. It was just kind of ugly. And, you know, and then there's a little short sort of aside with the story of Ruth, which is a very nice story. But then it's kind of come back to reality. And then we get to the book of 1 Samuel. Now, the first person that we see in Samuel is the story. It's the first primary character. It's the story of Hannah. And she is one of two wives. Okay. And so right there, there's already trouble. Okay. Guys, first lesson, don't marry two wives. Just marry one. Okay? You're not supposed to anyway right now. I think that's still the law. But the way marriage is being redefined now, who knows? You know, the whole same-sex marriage issue now, it's sort of a slippery slope kind of deal now, where the very next thing that came right up is now the issue of polygamy. See, if you say it's okay to marry same gender, well, who's to say you can't marry multiple? And you know where it's going to go from there. It's only going to get worse, okay? That's just like the time of the judges. Every man does what is right in his own eyes. Then you legislate that. You dismiss any sort of moral structure. And this is where you get kind of into trouble. Now, Elkanah, he has two wives. Wife named Peninnah, another named Hannah. Peninnah has children. Hannah doesn't. In that culture, to not have children, really big deal. Okay, if you are barren, essentially you're cursed. Okay, you are not blessed because your primary function as a woman, for all intents and purposes in that culture, is to bear children. So if you don't bear children, you didn't fulfill your purpose as a woman. So the culture is looking down upon you. So for a woman, that's a tremendous burden to bear. Remember the story of Sarah, Abraham and Sarah? She doesn't bear a child, so what does she do? She tells Abraham, hey, Abe, go have a baby through my servant, Hagar, okay? And because of that, we have the Middle East conflict, all right? Big problem coming out of that. Isaac, he at least only has one wife, but he plays favorites with his kids. That's not good. Jacob ends up getting tricked into marrying someone, and that's kind of like it came back to bite him. He was the trickster, right? He was the one who deceived his father into getting the blessing. So then his father-in-law tricks him, he ends up marrying Rachel's older sister, Leah, right? That has to be like the most shocking thing ever. I mean, can you imagine, guys? You have a big wedding celebration, but she's all veiled. You know, they probably kept all the lights all dim so you couldn't see. And then you actually, you're married, and you move in, you sleep in the same bed, you wake up the next morning, and you're like, who are you? You know? And I don't know. I still haven't come to a conclusion on whatever Leah's weak eyes mean, okay? But whatever it was, it wasn't helpful. And anyway, he didn't like her. You know, Rachel. So father says, you can marry Rachel. Now he has two wives. But then Rachel can't have children. So what does she do? Take my servant, have kids. Jacob's like, yes, honey, whatever you say. I mean, now you got 12 tribes, you know? Because then Leah's like, she stopped having kids. Okay, have my servant. What's Jacob thinking in all this? You know, guys, you know, if your wife said, hey, since I can't have children, I'm going to have a children through this other woman, so I'm going to invite her into our home, can you just have children with her that I'll claim as my own? What should you say to that? No. 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 Okay. Not that anyone would do that, but hopefully. Jacob played favorites too, but the point being, when someone didn't have a children, it led to a lot of problems. So you have Hannah here, and she's the second wife. So not only is it hard for her, she's going to be looked down upon by Peninnah, right? And she's having a tough time. Now, during this time, it's when Eli, he's a priest, but he's also the judge. And so they have a kind of a run-in. Why? Because Hannah goes, and she goes to, I believe it's Shiloh, and this is where the worship of God is taking place in the nation. She is going to pray, and she's praying because she is just very, very sad. Now, her husband, Elkanah, he gives a double portion to Hannah. So he actually favors her as a wife, which is not good either, right? Because what do you think that's going to do for the other wife?
Jealousy.
She's going to treat Hannah even worse. But Hannah's going to be kids, so that she's got one line that she's going to use that all the time, right? Hey, you're not having babies. What's wrong with you? You all dried up in there. Nothing's happening. Okay, I mean, so it says that her rival would provoke her bitterly to irritate her because the Lord had closed her womb. So ladies, right now, you know, most of you probably would not think about it yet, but imagine if you were in this kind of situation where someone, and you have to live with this person because you're all part of one family, she is bitterly irritating you day and night, and she's only, you know, pressing that one button, you know, you don't have a baby, make you feel bad all the time. Now, Elkanah, in verse 8, her husband said to her, Hannah, why do you weep? And why do you not eat? And why is your heart sad? Am I not better to you than 10 sons? Now, I don't know. I'm trying to imagine. Would I say that? If I was in that situation, do you think that would be helpful? Hannah, come on. It's okay. You got me. Am I not better? Am I not better than 10 sons? Now, she is greatly distressed, so she goes to the temple of the Lord and prays. She made a vow and said, O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your maidservant and remember me and not forget your maidservant, but will give your maidservant a son, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and a razor shall never come on his head. So basically, she's praying to God, and this is a very huge point. She's praying to God that God would provide a son that she would dedicate to serving the Lord. You know, the no razor touching the head is alluding to the Nazarite vow. Okay, so she's essentially saying, if you give me a son, I will dedicate him to your service. Now, when I see that kind of story, what typically comes to mind is when I was in college, I remember friends of mine who said, can you pray for me that God would let me get into med school so I could become a doctor, and later on when I get really rich, I will give back to God and I will serve him then, right? And so I'm thinking, okay, well, I mean, we can pray about it, but we'll see what actually happens later, okay? Let's say God actually answers that prayer, blesses you with what you desired, and if you made a vow that you would do something for God, will it actually happen? Now, sadly, I have not seen that happen too often. In fact, almost all of the people that said stuff like that, all the promises they made to serve God. You know, I remember one person who said, you know, pray that God would bless my business. And God did. And they actually fell away more from God. And you go, what happened? You know, so when you see a prayer like this, it's not that you can't pray for this, but then you got to ask, so what happened? Now, verse 12, came about as she continued praying before the Lord that Eli was watching her mouth. As for Hannah, she was speaking in her heart. Only her lips were moving, but her voice was not heard. So Eli thought she was drunk. Okay. Now, I don't know, this just sort of gives testimony to that whole time period. Here's the priest, the high priest, who just thinks she's drunk, okay? So even though this lady has come to pray, his discernment doesn't seem too keen. His assumption is that she's drunk. So he confronts her. Then Eli said to her, how long will you make yourself drunk? Put away your wine from you. Now, what did Eli just do here? He presumed, right? He presumed. Now, that'd be pretty sad, right? Like, what if you came to church one Sunday, you were having a really tough time, and I happened to see you during, you know, the service time, and you're like, I'm like, what in the world? Like, what are you doing? You drunk, man? And you're like, no, I was just praying. Yeah, that'd be pretty sad. Okay. The sin of presumption is horrible. But how many times have we actually done that? Have you ever presumed on someone? You look at them, you thought you knew what was going on, and then you passed judgment. Now, that's a horrible thing to do. Eli's not being very helpful here. But Hannah replies, no, my Lord, I am a woman oppressed in spirit. I have drunk neither wine nor strong drink, but I have poured out my soul before the Lord. Do not consider your maidservant as a worthless woman, for I have spoken until now out of my great concern and provocation. Then Eli answered and said, go in peace. May the God of Israel grant your petition that you have asked of him. She said, let your maidservant find favor in your sight. So the woman went her way and ate, and her face was no longer sad. So it's very interesting that through that exchange, Hannah actually takes hope. Okay, and so when Eli says, may God grant your petition, she's no longer sad, because now she has faith that God's going to answer her prayers. So essentially, she gets pregnant, and she gives birth. It says the Lord remembered her in verse 19. And she names him Samuel, because I have asked him of the Lord. Now every year, Elkanah would go up to offer the Lord the yearly sacrifice. But Hannah did not go up, verse 22. For she said to her husband, I will not go up until the child is weaned. Then I will bring him that he may appear before the Lord and stay there forever. So what you see is, she has every intention to actually carry out what she vowed. So here is a genuine woman of God. She didn't just pray, asking God to have her desires met for her sake. She actually was going to come through. She's going to remain true to her vow. So she says, okay, I'm not going to go up to the annual sacrifice until I've weaned him. Why? Because I basically have to wean him so that he can live apart from me. Okay. So when she had weaned him, verse 24, she took him up with her with a three-year-old bull, one ephah of flour, a jug of wine, and brought him to the house of the Lord in Shiloh, although the child was young. Then they slaughtered the bull, brought the boy to Eli. She said, oh, my Lord, as your soul lives, my Lord, I am the woman who stood here beside you praying to the Lord. For this boy I prayed, and the Lord has given me my petition, which I asked of him. So I have also dedicated him to the Lord. As long as he lives, he is dedicated to the Lord. And he worshiped the Lord there. And then when you look at chapter 2, starting from verse 1 through verse 10, here is Hannah's prayer. And it's a beautiful prayer. One of the things that you can do if you have struggles in knowing how to pray, reading how others have prayed, you know, even though it might not directly be relevant in every way, but what is relevant is you see the heart attitude before God. Whatever the situation might be, and you really see this, Hannah says, my heart exalts in the Lord, my horn is exalted in the Lord, my mouth speaks boldly against my enemies because I rejoice in your salvation. There is no one holy like the Lord. Indeed, there is no one besides you, nor is there any rock like our God. So what you see is this exaltation of God, this worship of God. That's really central. You know, she understands that really this is the greatness of God acting on her behalf. She can now essentially say to her enemies, okay, you know what? You know, whatever you say, it doesn't matter. I can speak boldly now because of who God is and what God has accomplished. You know, who God is, what he has done, and what he will ultimately accomplish. And so she has great hope in God. You know, her faith in God has, if you can imagine, it's been tremendously affirmed. And but then she leaves him there. Now, I've thought of that, about that. You know, that's kind of a weird thought to have. You have a kid, and then you leave him to serve God during a time where people aren't too interested in serving God. Not to mention that, you know, Eli, who is the religious leader of the people, he has sons. And look at verse 12. This is a horrible way to be remembered for eternity. Now the sons of Eli were worthless men. They did not know the Lord. And the custom of the priests or the people, when any man was offering sacrifice, the priest's servant would come while the meat was boiling with a three-pronged fork in his hand. Then he would thrust it into the pan or kettle or cauldron or pot. All that the fork brought up, the priest would take for himself. Thus they did in Shiloh to all the Israelites who came there. Also, before they burned the fat, the priest's servant would come and say to the man who sacrificed, and give the priest meat for roasting, and he will not take boiled meat from you, only raw. If the man said to him, they must surely burn the fat first and then take as much as you desire, then he would say, no, but you shall give it to me now, and if not, I will take it by force. Now, when you read through that, does that remind you of anything? But you go back to the law. Remember when God gave explicit instructions on here are the sacrifices, how they'd be carried out, and there was a portion that was to be given to the priest? Eli's sons, they're basically abusing their role, and they're taking whatever they want just to feed themselves. Thus the sin of the young man was very great before the Lord, for the men despised the offering of the Lord. Remember when Moses receives the law, and Aaron becomes a high priest, and his sons become priests also. And remember, they offer strange fire, so God strikes them down dead. Like, first day on the job. Why? Because they despised what God told them. They didn't keep holy what God asked them to do. So you could see what's coming now, okay? If you don't treat holy what God has called to be treated holy, there's going to be consequences. So Eli's sons, they're worthless men. Now Samuel was ministering before the Lord, verse 18. His mother would make him a little robe and bring it to him from year to year when she would come up with her husband to offer the yearly sacrifice. So imagine the heart of this mom. She gets to see her son once a year. And it says that she brought him a little robe. To me, I just imagine a little robe. You know, here you go, son, every year. You know, little robe. But he's getting bigger and bigger every year. Then Eli would bless Elkanah and his wife and say, may the Lord give you children from this woman in place of the one she dedicated to the Lord. And they went out to their own home. The Lord visited Hannah, and she conceived and gave birth to three sons and two daughters. So they've got a pretty full home. But the boy Samuel grew before the Lord. Now Eli rebukes his sons. Okay, he's old. he hears all that his sons were doing in all Israel. And on top of what they did with offerings, it says how they lay with the women who served at the doorway of the tent of meeting. Okay? So, this is bad. This is really bad. He said to them, "Why do you do such things, the evil things that I hear from all these people? No, my sons, for the report is not good, which I hear the Lord's people circulating. If one man sins against another, God will mediate for him. But if a man sins against the Lord, who can intercede for him? But they would not listen to the voice of their father, for the Lord desired to put them to death." Now, that is a very haunting verse to consider. Now, these sons were so hardened in their sin that essentially it's saying here, God is going to judge them. So they're not going to listen to anything their father has to say. So dark days for Eli's family. Chapter 3 is when we see the prophetic call to Samuel. It says, "Now the boy Samuel is ministering to the Lord before Eli, and word from the Lord was rare in those days. Visions were infrequent." Okay, so God's not really talking to his people. Why? Because they don't want to listen. They don't care for his word. Remember the book of Judges? It ends with those words, "Every man did what was right in his own eyes." They don't care about what God wants them to do anymore. So God doesn't talk. You know, in fact, when we get to the end of the prophets, and you know, we have the 400 years in between the Old and New Testament, we call that what? The silent years. Because God stops talking. Like, period. Why? Because the nation of Israel, they've completely apostatized. They've rejected everything about God, and then they face judgment. "Now it happened at a time as Eli was lying down in his place. Now his eyesight had begun to grow dim. He could not see well. The lamp had not yet gone out. Samuel was lying down in the temple of the Lord where the ark of God was. That the Lord called Samuel and he said, 'Here I am.'" Now Samuel, he's young. I don't know exactly how old he is. But he's young, he's conscious, he knows what's going on, but he runs to Eli and says, "Here I am, for you called me." So he thought Eli was calling him. Eli's like, "No, you know, I didn't call you, lie down." The Lord calls again, verse 6, "Samuel." So Samuel arose, went to Eli, said, "Here I am, for you called." But he answered, "I did not call my son, lie down again." Now Samuel did not yet know the Lord, nor had the word of the Lord yet been revealed to him. So here, this is where we see God, he is literally calling Samuel to himself. He's calling him to serve him. The Lord called Samuel again for the third time, and he rose and went to Eli and said, "Here I am, for you called me." Then Eli discerned that the Lord was calling the boy. Now that's kind of a bittersweet sentence there to hear, because who is not getting any messages from God now?
Eli.
But he's the guy in charge. And he's watching like a little boy get messages from God. This has got to be tremendously humbling for him. But to his credit, Eli said to Samuel, "Go lie down, and it shall be if he calls you that you shall say, 'Speak, Lord, for your servant is listening.'" So Samuel went and lay down in his place. Then the Lord came and stood and called as at other times, "Samuel, Samuel." And Samuel said, "Speak, for your servant is listening." Imagine this scene happening. Okay? This is kind of crazy. The Lord said to Samuel, "Behold, I am about to do a thing in Israel at which both ears of everyone who hears it will tingle." Did you hear that? What does that mean? Your ears are going to tingle. If you just read through that and you're like, whatever. No, what is it? What's happening? Okay, imagine. What's the tingling sort of by a picture? Okay, big news. Big news. Okay, some bigs come in. "For I have told him that I am about to judge his house forever for the iniquity which he knew, because his sons brought a curse on themselves and he did not rebuke them. Therefore I have sworn to the house of Eli that the iniquity of Eli's house shall not be atoned for by sacrifice or offering forever." Okay, now imagine if you came to God's altar to make a sacrifice for atonement of sin. And essentially, that's symbolic of what's going to happen at the cross. And when you do that, when you offer that guilt offering, the sin offering, remember all the offerings that we talked about learned in Leviticus, you were told by the priests, your sins are forgiven. Okay. But God is saying here now, for Eli and his household, what is it? Okay. "This iniquity of Eli's house shall not be atoned for by sacrifice or offering forever." Now, if there's no other harsher judgment that you know you could hear, I don't know of it. He's basically saying Eli and his household, they're judged. They are condemned. There is no hope. This is coming from God himself. So it's not even like the prophet or, you know, the priest. God is making a declaration. Imagine being a little boy, your first time hearing God, and this is the message you get. So Samuel lay down until morning. Okay, that's another like one of those understated verses. You think he slept after that? I don't think so. He probably lay there and he's like, uh-oh. When I get up, when Eli gets up, he's going to probably ask me what God said. And do I tell him? What do I tell him? Well, Eli calls him over. Samuel, my son. And he said, here I am. So this time it is Eli. He said, what is the word that he spoke to you? Please do not hide it from me. May God do so to you, and more also, if you hide anything from me of all the words that he spoke to you. Imagine just now. Imagine if it was you now. Like, you heard this message from God, and then you go to the most significant religious leader in the whole country, and he says, tell me everything God told you, and if you don't, whatever God told you, may that happen to you and more. Okay, so Samuel's probably going, God just said, no atonement, condemned forever. I don't want that. And I don't want to get in trouble either, but better to get in trouble by telling him than to have that curse laid upon me. So Samuel told him everything and hid nothing from him. And here's Eli. It is the Lord. Let him do what seems good to him. Then Samuel grew and the Lord is with him, and let none of his words fail. So Samuel is blessed. Because not only does he hear God's word, he honors God's word. All Israel from Dan, even to Beersheba, knew that Samuel is confirmed as a prophet of the Lord. And the Lord appeared again at Shiloh because the Lord revealed himself to Samuel at Shiloh by the word of the Lord. So Samuel now is affirmed as one who is going to proclaim God's truth. Now this is pretty significant. He's the last judge in a series of judges. But he's also, you know, if you remember, most of the judges were either military leaders, and they simply kind of provided a military rescue for the nation from oppression. But then as we saw, their lives weren't very, they didn't come through on the godliness side. Like Gideon, he doesn't turn out too well. Even though he was given probably out of any of them, you know, the whole fleece deal. You know, he laid out a fleece before God. God honored that request twice. You know, you would think that if God were to, in a sense, accommodate you, even though what you're essentially saying is you're questioning God, and he accommodates you, you would think you'd do a little better than that. No, and in the end, Gideon's sons, they all turn out bad too. So these judges are not very necessarily long-term solutions. But Samuel here, you know, he is a faithful one. Now, in the context of 1 Samuel, the Philistines were the primary group of people that was giving Israel a hard time. And so basically, they're the ones who are fighting with Israel. And as they're fighting, and this is what Israel does, because they basically want to see if they can use the Ark of the Covenant as like a good luck charm. Okay, look at verse 3 of chapter 4. When the people came into the camp, the elders of Israel said, why has the Lord defeated us today before the Philistines? Let us take to ourselves from Shiloh the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, that it may come among us and deliver us from the power of our enemies. Now, what's the problem with that? Was it the Ark of the Covenant that brought victory? No. What was it? You can say it more confidently. God, right? Now, yes, the nation of Israel carried the Ark of the Covenant, but it wasn't the Ark of the Covenant itself. Right? So what you see is just a very, very short-sighted view. But it kind of rallies the people. So they carry in verse 5, as the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord came to the camp, all Israel shouted with a great shout so that the earth resounded. So they're pretty excited now. The Ark is here! The Ark is here! We're going to kick butt now! I mean, we're going to beat these Philistines because the Ark is here. Now, the Philistines hear all this shouting, and this is in verse 7, the Philistines were afraid, for they said, God has come into the camp. And they said, "Woe to us, for nothing like this has happened before. Woe to us, who shall deliver us from the hand of these mighty gods? These are the gods who smote the Egyptians with all kinds of plagues and horrors." Now, Philistines, their theology is not too great either. They say gods, there's only one. But they remember the stories. They remember that the God of Israel beat down the gods of Egypt. But it's interesting. They say, "Take courage," verse 9, "and be men, O Philistines, or you'll become slaves of the Hebrews, as they have been slaves to you. Therefore, be men and fight." Okay, so they said, okay, it doesn't matter that they have this ark. Let's go fight them. So the Philistines fought and Israel was defeated. Every man fled to his tent and the slaughter was very great, for there fell of Israel 30,000 foot soldiers. 30,000, that's a lot of people to die. And the ark of God was taken, and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, died. This is bad. This is really bad. Now a man of Benjamin ran from the battle line, came to Shiloh the same day with his clothes torn, dust on his beard. And when he came, behold, Eli was sitting on his seat by the road, eagerly watching, because his heart was trembling for the ark of God. So the man came to tell it in the city, and all the city cried out. When Eli heard the noise of the outcry, he said, "What does the noise of this commotion mean?" Then the man came hurriedly and told Eli. Now Eli was 98 years old, okay, so he's pretty old. His eyes were set so that he could not see. Okay, so his eyes, he's essentially blind. The man said to Eli, "I am the one who came from the battle line. Indeed, I escaped from the battle line today." And he said, "How did things go, my son?" Then the one who brought the news replied, "Israel has fled before the Israelites. There's also been a great slaughter among the people, 30,000. And your two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, are dead. And the ark of God has been taken." This is all bad news. Now, Eli, it says, when he mentioned the ark of God, Eli fell off the seat backward beside the gate. His neck was broken, and he died, for he was old and heavy. I mean, what a way to like be described. Like your last, this is your last mention in Scripture. You're blind, you're old, you're heavy, you fell back, broke your neck, and died. Thus he judged Israel 40 years. Man, what a sad epitaph, you know. I mean, imagine if you're putting on his tombstone. This is how it went out. Now, this is what's really sad. His daughter-in-law, Phinehas' wife, was pregnant and about to give birth. And when she heard news that the Ark of God was taken and that her father-in-law and her husband had died, she kneeled down, gave birth, for her pains came upon her. And about the time of her death, the woman who stood by her said to her, "Do not be afraid, for you have given birth to a son." But she did not answer or pay attention. Now, we just had several births take place in our church context here recently, right? And that's usually a pretty happy occasion, right? Mike, is that a happy occasion? Yeah. I mean, did you not answer or pay attention when the baby came out? You know, when they said, "Hey, you have a new baby!" I'd be pretty sad if you did, right? But this is what's really sad. Her last words, she's dying. I mean, can you imagine? You are dying as you just gave birth, and you name your child in the context of your emotional state. She names the boy Ichabod, because Ichabod means the glory has departed. I mean, this is like all hope is gone. I mean, imagine this boy. It doesn't say anything about this boy after this. So we have no idea. Like, you learned that your father died, and he was a bad guy too, right? He was stealing the meat, and he was having affairs with women at the temple. And mom dies and gives me this name. Like, grandpa died, fell over because he broke his neck because he was heavy. I mean, there's nothing good about this situation. But then the ark of God was taken. I mean, that's the big deal, right? Because the symbol of the Ark of the Covenant was God's covenant presence was going to be with them, right? So when he told them to build this Ark in their very specific details and, you know, there were regulations, you know, that's why they had poles, you weren't supposed to touch it, you weren't supposed to put in something else, and when you picked it up, it had to be taken a certain way. But it was all kind of a symbol of God's presence with the people. So in effect, it's God's presence has departed. So they really don't have hope. Okay? Now, the fact is God's presence already had been rejected. That's the problem. So, this is a very sad time during the time of Israel. Now, the Philistines, I like chapter 5. Chapter 5 is, to me, a hilarious chapter. The Philistines take the ark. They brought it from Ebenezer to Ashdod. And the Philistines took the ark of God and brought it to the house of Dagon and set it by Dagon. Now, Dagon is a Philistine god, okay? And I think it's like the fish god or something like that. So basically, he looks like a fish or something like that. So it's an idol. It's just an idol. Okay? It's their idol. And they're basically ascribing to their god, Dagon, victory over the God of the Israelites. So they set the ark before Dagon. When the Ashdodites arose early the next morning, behold, Dagon had fallen on his face to the ground before the ark of the Lord. Okay? What? You know, can you imagine? They wake up and they see their God is like literally bowing to the ark of the covenant. And you might think, maybe there was an earthquake. It just happened to tip over. Okay, they put it back up. The next morning, Dagon had fallen on his face to the ground before the ark of the Lord, and the head of Dagon and both the palms of his hands were cut off on the threshold. Only the trunk of Dagon was left to him. Now, just imagine that. Just imagine that, okay? Maybe first time, coincidence. Second day, head is chopped off, hands are chopped off, just the body, the trunk is there. Verse 5, this to me is the funny verse. Therefore, neither the priests of Dagon nor all who enter Dagon's house tread on the threshold of Dagon and Ashdod to this day. Why? Loser God. Like, Dagon just got beat down. They're like, we can't worship a God like that. Can you imagine what's going on in their pagan minds? How do you reconcile that? We just had this great victory, and but Dagon just got totally worked. So the hand of the Lord was heavy on the Ashdodites. He ravaged them and smote them with tumors, both Ashdod and its territories. So there is judgment being placed on this group of people. So they say the ark of God, the God of Israel, must not remain here. His hand is severe on us and on Dagon, our God. So they sent and gathered all the lords of the Philistines and said, what shall we do with the ark of the God of Israel? And they said, let the ark of the God of Israel be brought around to Gath. And they brought the ark of the God of Israel around. When they brought it around, the hand of the Lord was against the city with great confusion. He smote the men of the city, both young and old, so that tumors broke out on them. Now, we don't know what that literally means, but later on, they're going to make an offering of golden tumors. So whatever these tumors were, they must have been actually, like, visible. They're growing things. It's got to look like really horrible. So they sent the ark of God to Ekron, and the ark of God came to Ekron. The Ekronites cried out, saying, they have brought the ark of God Israel around to kill us and our people. So they basically understand, we can't have this. Send away the ark of God of Israel. Let it return to his own people so that it will not kill us and our people. For there was a deadly confusion throughout the city. The hand of God was very heavy there. The men who did not die were smitten with tumors, and the cry of the city went to heaven. So for 7 months, the Philistines are getting destroyed. They're dying. Everyone who's not dying has got tumors. I mean, can you imagine? Can you just imagine life like that? That'd be pretty sick. You just look at each other. Hey, good morning. You got a tumor sticking out of your head. You know, I mean, hey, you got a tumor sticking out of your neck. I mean, everyone's got tumors. Philistines call the priests, the diviners, saying, what shall we do with the ark of the Lord? Tell us how we shall send it to its place. Now, this is a very interesting story. Like, these are pagan people, and they're trying to appease God. If you send away the ark of God of Israel, do not send it empty. Okay, so they at least know something. Man, you got to take ownership. We did something wrong, so we got to pay. We got to do some sacrifice. We got to offer something. You shall surely return to him a guilt offering, then you will be healed, and it will be known to you why his hand is not removed from you. Then they said, what shall be the guilt offering? Oh, so they come up with a guilt offering, just like the Israelites were given a guilt offering. They said, 5 golden tumors and 5 golden mice, according to the number of the lords of the Philistines, for one plague, was on all of you and your Lord. So the speculation is that somehow mice were involved. You know, maybe something like the bubonic plague kind of idea. Mice, you know, basically God used mice to spread around infections, and then they all got tumors. And so they make an image of mice and tumors. I mean, that's their offering. I mean, wouldn't you think that's kind of a weird offering? But they're acknowledging, what they're doing is they're acknowledging the judgment that has been placed against them or on them. So you shall make likenesses of your tumors, likenesses of your mice that ravage the land. You shall give glory to the God of Israel. Perhaps he will ease his hand from you, your gods, and your land. Why then do you harden your hearts as the Egyptians and Pharaoh hardened their hearts? When he had severely dealt with them, did they not allow the people to go and they departed? Someone read their history. Okay, do you see what's important to read history? The Philistines actually saved kind of their people by remembering what happened to the Egyptians. Now therefore, take and prepare a new cart, 2 milch cows on which there has never been a yoke, hitch the cows to the cart, take their calves home, away from them, take the ark of the Lord, place it on the cart, and put the articles of gold which you return to him as a guilt offering in a box by its side, then send it away that it may go. Watch if it goes by the way of its own territory to Beth Shemesh, then he has done us this great evil. But if not, then we will know that it was not his hand that struck us. It happened to us by chance. Okay, so what are they doing? They're setting up a test. Okay, and they're making it pretty difficult. You're taking cows that have never been yoked, and they are milking cows. They're mother cows. They have calves. They're going to take the calves away, and they're going to take them in the opposite direction, and they're going to see if these unyoked cows who've never done this kind of thing in their life, taken away from their calves, will then drag this wagon filled with the guilt offerings back to Beth Shemesh, which is, you know, where the Israelites are. So they go, if it doesn't happen, then they'll know it just happened by chance. Verse 10, then the men did so and took 2 milch calves and hitched them in the cart, shut up their calves at home. They put the ark of the Lord on the cart and the box with the golden mice, likenesses of their tumors, and the cows took the straight way in the direction of Beth Shemesh. They went along the highway, lowing as they went, and did not turn aside to the right or to the left. Okay, so imagine this. Why do you think the cows are lowing? Okay, another word for mooing. You know, they're probably like, moo, moo. And if you could translate what they're saying, it's like, this is not the right way. Our calves are back there, but we're going this way. Like, they're being drawn. You know, I mean, who knows what's going on in their minds. But they are like just being led straight to where they need to go. And it's not going to end well for them. Okay? So the lords of the Philistines, so they're watching. Imagine, the Philistines, they're watching this happen. People of Beth Shemesh were reaping their wheat harvest in the valley. They raised their eyes, saw the ark, and were glad to see it. The cart came to the field of Joshua the Beth Shemite and stood there where there was a large stone. They split the wood of the cart, offered the calves as a burnt offering to the Lord. Levites took down the ark of the Lord, box that was with it, in which were the articles of gold, put them in on the large stone. The men of Beth Shemesh offered burnt offerings, sacrifices that day to the Lord. When the 5 lords of the Philistines saw it, they returned to Ekron that day. So the Philistines actually watched that whole thing happen. And they're like, okay, we did what we needed to do because this was of God. So we had to make that guilt offering. And the Israelites, they see. But this is kind of sad too. Look at verse 19. He struck down some of the men of Beth Shemesh because they had looked into the ark of the Lord. He struck down of all the people 50,070 men. Now, I find that kind of odd. Why not just say 50,000? 50,000, that's a lot of people. Even for that time, you know, you think about it, even for our time, that would be a lot of people. But it's because they had dishonored God. Look at verse 20. Who is able to stand before the Lord, this holy God? And to whom shall he go up from us? So the Israelites, this is a reflection of their spiritual state. Now, you know, okay, we spent so much time on this part. We haven't even gotten to like Saul and David. But this is just, again, what's very indicative of when a people have rejected God. They misuse the things of God, like the Ark of the Covenant. And even when the Ark of the Covenant is returned, they're still not conducting themselves in a way that treats God holy. Instead, they're just kind of curious to look and see what's in the Ark. Okay, so they have no respect for God. Now, this is the kind of situation where Samuel then is trying to call the people back. So verse 7, Samuel spoke to all the house of Israel, if you return to the Lord with all your heart, remove the foreign gods and the Ashtoreth from among you and direct your hearts to the Lord and serve him alone, he will deliver you from the hand of the Philistines. And so the sons of Israel removed the Baals, the Ashtoreth, served the Lord alone. Okay, so he's calling them to worship God alone. And the people do it. And so there is redemption. But it doesn't last long, because the next thing they ask for in chapter 8 is they want a king. Now this is a part of the real story of Samuel too. Look at verse 5, chapter 8. Okay, the elders are gathered together. They said to him, behold, you have grown old and your sons do not walk in your ways. That's a sad thing to have to acknowledge. Samuel has walked faithfully with God, but his sons have not. And so they say, appoint a king for us to judge us like all the nations. This thing was displeasing in the sight of Samuel when they said, give us a king to judge us. Samuel, you know, that had to hurt. But then the Lord said to Samuel, listen to the voice of the people in regard to all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them. Like all the deeds which they have done since the day that I brought them up from Egypt, even to this day, in that they have forsaken me and served other gods, so they are doing to you also. So this is a sad testament to the nation of Israel. Though they had been saved by God, rescued from Egypt, brought to the promised land, they've been saved time and time again, you know, through the judges, they don't want God as their king. They want to be like the other nations. Samuel warns them and says, you know, this king, he's going to basically impose upon you. He's going to take things that you own, your children, everything. And then the people say, good, that's fine. We're okay. Saul is chosen. And the thing about Saul is, if you were to, I don't know, you know, there's like those shows like The Bachelor or The Bachelorette, right? I mean, not that I've watched them. But basically, there's some sort of sequence of how, you know, they have to all sort of kind of pass before the one person that's going to make the final decision, and they all sort of get weeded out until the final selection. And so, ladies, if you were like the Bachelorette and you're going to choose someone to marry, what kind of guy would you marry? Now, we're at church, so I know you're going to have to say, well, he should be a Christian, love Jesus, and, you know, he should be godly, and hopefully, you know, somewhat decent looking, and not too nerdy, good personality, has a sense of humor, but godly, you know. So, now, and then you ask the guys, okay, so what kind of woman should you marry? And they're going to say the same thing. Well, you know, she should love the Lord. But she should hopefully be lovely, but she should love the Lord, and but she should be kind of hot, and you know, so we could be hot for the Lord together. Okay, so you can say whatever you want, but in the end, you know, you'll be revealed for what you really desire. So what kind of king do you think, what kind of king do you think the Israelites want? They want a king like the other nations around them. Not a king that would serve God. That's there's a big kind of distinction there. They want to be like the other people. They want to be accepted, approved by the world. Now, in principle, that applies even to this day. Like, think about church. You know, you remember something called the Seeker Sensitive Movement? It's still going on to somewhat now, but maybe back in the 80s and 90s, it was in its heyday. And essentially, it was the church was trying to find the world's approval so that people would come to church. You know, and the flagship church at that time was Willow Creek, you know, in the suburbs of Chicago. I've been there. I went during the heyday, and it's impressive. I have to give them that. You know, I remember walking in, there were monitors everywhere. It was like going to the airport, you know, and it would tell you where to go. And the seating in the sanctuary was theater seating. You had your own individual cushioned seat. No having to share space, you know, you had your own private space. And it was like going to a concert. It was like MTV. I remember going to the youth night, and it was like watching an MTV video as they were performing. They had a drummer suspended in air on top of another drummer. It was like crazy. There was like, you know, acoustic drums and electronic drums, and they were good. And they were singing Billy Joel songs. And I was thinking, I mean, I don't know that much secular music, but I was like, that's not Christian music. I know that. It was, I remember the song, it was In the Middle of the Night, something like that, right? It was kind of big back then, maybe not now, it's 20 years ago. All I remember thinking was like, but they're not singing songs about God. I don't understand. But it was, this is how you draw in the people. And they were good. They were so good. And so you had thousands of people there. I mean, I think there were literally like 1,200 people there for their high school group. It was crazy. And they had the most incredible gym. It was like, if you'd gone to UCLA, like the Wooden Center, it was like that. Three full courts, you know, it was just crazy. So, you know, I admit sometimes on my more, you know, like fleshly days, you know, you go, it'd be kind of nice to have a church with a gym and, you know, things like, not that's a bad thing, but if you wanted to use those things to, in a sense, win the approval of those around you, what have you done? You just kind of kicked God out of the picture. You just want God to do something for what you want him to do. You're not actually there to promote true worship of God. That's essentially what Israel's problem was. So when God gives them, the bachelor. Okay? Tall, dark, handsome. Literally, he's tall, dark, and handsome. He's literally a head taller than everyone else. He can't even hide. You know, everyone else, they're kind of short. He's like above. And he is like manly dude. Okay? He's like a military guy. And he's what they wanted. But the sad thing is, he's sort of sissy boy too. Okay. Like when it comes time to announce him, he's hiding. He's hiding. Samuel told him, be ready. And then when it's time to present him, he's hiding. And Samuel's like, where'd he go? Where is he? That's not a good start. Not a good start. And it just gets worse from there. Samuel had great hope that Saul would be God's man. But what he finds out is later, Saul is going to take things into his own hands. And the thing that he does, that is the worst thing that he does, Samuel says, wait, certain date, I'm going to make the offerings before God. You're going to be called to go, you know, lead the nation out to war. Samuel's running a little late. Saul's getting a little anxious. So he says, you know what? I'm going to make the sacrifice. And he wasn't supposed to. It was not in his place to do so. But he takes things into his own hands. He defies what God's instructions were, and then Samuel walks in on it. He's like, what are you doing? He's like, well, you were not on time, and so I didn't want the people to go crazy, so I just had to do it. And Samuel said, no, you just blew it. You just blew it. And that was where the downfall came. Why? Because Saul did not honor God. He didn't have a heart to truly follow God. Now, Samuel still is holding out hope. So he sends them out to go against Agag. And look at chapter 14. Okay, I'm sorry, chapter 15. So Saul is told to go and wipe out the Amalekites. Now, it sounds kind of harsh. And this is what some people today say. This is why we don't like the God of the Old Testament, because how come the God of the Old Testament is about wiping out whole people groups? Well, note what it says there. He's punishing Amalek for what he did to Israel, how he set himself against him on the way while he was coming up from Egypt. Amalek had sinned against God. Now you got to remember, sin is an offense against God. So when God exercises judgment, it is because he is exercising just and righteous judgment. You know, some people only see it as like, this God is kind of a cruel God. No, God is simply kind of taking all the people in one swoop, but they're all going to face his judgment. Now, Saul is given this task. What does he do? He takes him out, but He captured, verse 8, Agag, the king of the Amalekites, alive, and utterly destroyed all the people with the edge of the sword. But Saul and the people spared Agag, the best of the sheep, the oxen, the fatlings, the lambs, and all that was good, and were not willing to destroy them utterly, but everything despised and worthless, that they utterly destroyed. So they obeyed up to a point. But partial obedience is?
Disobedience.
Right? Word of the Lord came to Samuel saying, I regret that I've made Saul king, for he's turned back from following me and has not carried out my commandments. Samuel was distressed, cried out to the Lord all night. So Samuel confronts Saul. Saul says, blessed are you of the Lord. I have carried out the command of the Lord. How can he say that? He didn't carry out the command of the Lord. Samuel said, what then is this bleating of the sheep in my ears, the lowing of the oxen which are here? Saul said, they have brought them from the Amalekites, for the people spared the best of the sheep and oxen to sacrifice to the Lord your God, but the rest we have utterly destroyed. Then Samuel said to Saul, wait, and let me tell you what the Lord said to me last night. And he said to him, speak. Samuel said, is it not true that you were little in your own eyes? You were made the head of the tribes of Israel, and the Lord anointed you king over Israel, and the Lord sent you on a mission and said, go and utterly destroy the sinners and the Amalekites. Fight against them until they are exterminated. Why then did you not obey the voice of the Lord, but rushed upon the spoil and did what was evil in the sight of the Lord? Then Saul said to Samuel, I did obey the voice of the Lord and went on the mission on which the Lord had sent me, and brought back Agag, the king of Amalek, and have utterly destroyed the Amalekites. But the people took some of the spoil, sheep and oxen, the choice. What did he just do here? He just shifted blame. And he didn't obey. And notice he says, they took some of the spoil, sheep and oxen, the choice of the things devoted to destruction, to sacrifice to the Lord your God at Gilgal. Now that one little word, your, do you think that makes a difference? Why? What should he have said?
My.
I mean, if you own God as your Lord, shouldn't you say my? But he can't. Why? Because he disobeyed. Here are the very, very well-known words, which we need to take to heart too. Samuel said, has the Lord as much delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, you should underline this or highlight this, or star it or something. Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed than the fat of lambs. You cannot give enough sacrifices. You cannot work hard enough and offer to God your service when you've defied God in disobedience. Verse 23, for rebellion is as the sin of divination, and insubordination is as iniquity and idolatry. Wow. Disobedience is essentially telling God, I want to worship another God. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he has also rejected you from being king. Then Saul said to Samuel, I have sinned, I have indeed transgressed the command of the Lord in your words, because I feared the people and listened to their voice. It's a little late now, but what's he saying? I just wanted to win the approval of the people. Please pardon my sin, return with me that I may worship the Lord. Samuel said to Saul, I will not return with you, for you've rejected the word of the Lord. The Lord has rejected you from being king over Israel. I mean, these are just like such, you know, haunting words to have to hear. Samuel turned to go. Saul seized the edge of the robe, and it tore. This is just like so dramatic a scene. Samuel said, the Lord has torn the kingdom of Israel from you today and has given it to your neighbor who is better than you. Also, the glory of Israel will not lie or change his mind, for he is not a man that he should change his mind. Wow. Okay. So God's basically saying, you know what, God, this is it. There's no turning back. You had a chance. You had this opportunity, and you blew it. When he tears a robe, I mean, that's that seals the deal. Well, to sum up the rest of the story, because we could spend hours. Basically, Saul's life is going like this, and then Samuel gets told, go find a new king. So he finds a guy named Jesse. Who's Jesse? David's father. But who was his father?
Obed.
Who was the son of? Boaz and Ruth, right? So, you know, things are converging. And God had this redemptive plan laid out. So remember when Ruth goes out with her husband and two sons and they die, and then, you know, they marry Moabites and they come back with, you know, Ruth, and Ruth marries Boaz, and then they have Obed, and Obed has Jesse, and Jesse got married, and he has seven sons, and he brings up the sons, and he starts off with, you know, the oldest, right? Who's the oldest? Right? The oldest should always be king, right? I'm the oldest. I should be king, right? That's the Asian way. Essentially, they're like Asians here, right? When Samuel goes, he brings out the oldest. Verse 6, Eliab. Surely the Lord's anointed is before him. Look at verse 7. The Lord said to Samuel, do not look at his appearance or at the height of his stature, because I have rejected him. For God sees not as man sees, for man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. Okay. Now, there's all sorts of stuff involved here. I mean, the immediate context is obviously the king, but the general principle is true. What does God care about? The heart. The heart. You can look good on the outside. Okay, I got to tell you this story. This is funny. Today, we're driving down Del Mar Boulevard, and we're looking at this. There's a school that we might possibly look at for our church. So I was driving by. I told Libby, I go, Libby, this is a church that we, I mean, this is a school that we might actually consider for being a church facility. And she was like, what? School? So I turned, and we're looking at it. She goes, wow, it looks pretty nice. So from her vantage point, it actually looked nice. It's kind of old looking, but, you know, she can't distinguish too much. So I'm like, well, I said, but we have to go take a look. And she's like, oh, you know, you really should. Because it might look good on the outside, but you never know what it might look like on the inside. And I was like, wow. It blew my mind. She's 8 years old, and she's like, she said that. I was like, Livy, that is so true. Thank you for telling that, because, you know, I mean, I was like, wow. How did she know that? How did she know that? Well, you know, maybe she has some good Sunday school teachers or something. They told her the story. Yeah, good job, man. Because, man, that principle, she like got that principle in her mind. She's like, you just can't tell by the outside. And then she goes, it's like looking at their heart. Okay, just I could die and go to heaven now because, you know, man, I am so, I didn't get to tell Angus yet. So it happened today. It happened today. And then it went to, you know, Daddy, you know, sometimes there's like stuffed animals that have hearts on their outside. Okay, we just, you know. So anyway, but I was like, wow, that was such a good setup for today, because I was like, you know, I was thinking exactly about this verse, because that's what the Bible says too. God looks at the heart. Now, you can apply that principle in many other contexts too. You know, we won't take the time to do it, but that's, you should be concerned about what God's looking at. God's always looking at the heart. You know, for me, like for my girls, that's what I'm telling them too. Don't let some smooth-talking guy who looks all slick just kind of grab your heart, okay? You got to make sure that they're humble before God, okay? And they're like, how do you know? And they go, just come talk to me. You know, but it's true. You know, I don't want you to end up with some lame-o guy. You know, it's like the high school quarterback guy that can't even read. You know, much less serve God. You know, just because he can throw a ball doesn't mean anything. All right, it's his heart. Sorry, I'm gonna carry you away. And that's the thing. That's why Saul, no heart. His heart for God, it wasn't there. David, okay, now. He's not even part. He doesn't even get chosen to come out. He's out in the field. So when Samuel walks through all the sons, they're like, God is saying, nope, 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 nope. So then he goes, you got anyone else? And then Jesse's like, well, yeah, we got the youngest guy. And he's the runt, okay? He's like the squirt. It says that he was ruddy. That's another like term for it. He was like red-haired. And back in that culture, red hair, you're kind of like weird. Even today, if you're red-haired, I mean, you're a little different. You're a little different here, right? So David, he's the youngest. He's the smallest. He's got red hair. And then even dad doesn't even take the time to bring him into the line. He's like, there's no way. And then God says what? He's the guy. So he's the guy. And Samuel must have been going, huh? Okay, God, you say so. Your call. And then he anoints him. And it's secret. No one else knows. No one else in the whole world knows except their family. Okay, we're just going to have to continue next time because there's so much. But the exciting thing, and this is why I get kind of like excited about going through the whole story. Every step of the way, it just like doesn't make sense. But God, this is how God tends to do things. He's not going to do it the way we would think. He's not going to always use the people that we think. You know, we would have looked at Saul and said, oh, he looks manly. No, man, he was a sissy boy, but mostly no heart for God. If we were there, if we wanted to be part of the committee to choose the king, next king, okay, let's put it in a more current day context. What if we had to choose a new pastor? What kind of pastor would you want to choose? Would you want to choose someone that, I mean, they've got to look like pastoral. And they got to have like some like, they got to have the preacher's voice. And you know, and they got to be like a real leader, but they got to be really like tender. And they got to be really firm, but they got to be really gentle. I mean, in the end, you're going to be wanting all this kind of stuff. And then, you know, say candidating, you know, some guy walks in. And he's like everything that you didn't think he would be. Like, he's got a high voice. Can we all turn to 1 Samuel chapter 4? And you're like, oh! You know? And maybe he's like, and you know. Like, he just said, you know, like 50 times. It's driving me crazy. And then what if God were just to supernaturally just be able to tell you, give you a message? I did like the screen just lit up and said, I chose him. He said, deal with it. But that's what God does. You know, God used David ultimately to become the greatest king. But we're going to find out, and 1 Samuel kind of carries this out. I mean, 2 Samuel carries this out, where he messes up a whole lot too. But the difference between Saul and David is that David knows to go back to God. Saul's story ends tragically. Like in the handout, it says that one author says that Shakespeare must have studied the story of Saul before he wrote Macbeth. Okay? And I don't even remember all the details about Macbeth other than it's just a tragedy. Right? Ends up bad. Because Saul ends up bad. Saul basically does, he goes looking for a witch. He had forbidden witchcraft in the whole nation. He goes looking for a witch. So he pretends to be someone else. He's looking for a witch. Someone says, there's a witch at Endor. Star Wars. Satan. Okay, no. So it's kind of eerie. Why did George Lucas pick Endor? It just is freaky. Anyway. Yeah. And then, you know, he wants to talk to Samuel. Samuel's dead. And then the spirit of Samuel comes up and says, tomorrow you're going to die, your son's going to die, it's all over. And then the witch goes, you're Saul! And she's going to think, I'm dead! But why did he come? It's going to be really confusing. And she goes, eat! And he eats, and then the next day, he dies. It's sad. It's so sad. If you follow the story, it's very tragic. He was king for 40 years. 40 years! That's a long time. Most of you have not been alive that long. He had 40 years of opportunity to turn back to God, and he did it. The difference, and we'll see it in 2 Samuel, even though David blows it big time, what we know he does is he confesses. And he goes, but he still has to suffer the consequences of all his decisions.